Yes, it's working now. Could you tell me how you first sort of got acquainted with Eleanor? I mean, how did you get make contact with her?
Well, at that time, I was working as an invoice clerk in John Lewis. I was about 16, and it was soul destroying. And also, in those days, 26 shillings was the pay, and I sort of thought I just couldn't manage money-wise anymore, and went to the superior, who then offered 4 shillings extra, which of course was no good for a 16-year-old girl who had to fend completely for herself. Literally everything. That I spoke to friends of mine, and I was extremely lucky. Someone was working for Eva Habak, who was then the principal of Morley College. And I got to know this particular person in evening classes.
That's not Anna Nelke, is it?
Yes.
Oh, yes, I've met her.
Yes, you met her. How lovely.
Yes, she lives in South London now, doesn't she?
Does she live
in...
Well, I've lost touch.
Oh, well, I'll tell you about her.
I don't know her very well.
Yes. She was the intermediary then, was she, between you and Eleanor?
Anna Nelke, we were both attending a 3-year evening course on sociology. And it was in the second year, and...
At Morley College?
No, not at Morley College. Extramural studies somewhere. I hadn't known Mrs. Nelke before. It was... We got talking, and at the time, I didn't look like 17 or 16. I literally looked like 11, because obviously in 24 shillings, you can imagine... So it was in a kind of maternal way she sort of wondered whether I'd eaten enough or... And then I explained the position to her, and she said, well, Eva Habak had said that Eleanor was looking for somebody who could speak German, who could do shorthand, who could do typing, etc., etc. And why don't I try? So I thought to myself, my shorthand is practically nil, my typing is nil, my German is very good, my education is such, is there, but in bits, a bit of French education, a fair amount of German education, evening classes, but nothing really finished off. And so I made an appointment with Vera Krieg, who was the secretary, as you know, of the parliamentary committee in Eleanor.
Yes, I don't actually know very much about this, because I come to all this through the women's movement. So what was the name?
Vera Krieg.
Yes,
Vera Krieg.
She
was the secretary. Eleanor was, I think, the chairman. So something in that, there was Graham White, I forget all the other MPs were... Anyhow, it was for a Saturday. And the funny thing was, that particular Saturday, it was so foggy, and my finances were rock bottom, that I was really thinking to myself, shall I invest the fares to go there? It's probably going to be nothing, because I'm so... I mean, if they give me a test, I'll fail it. However, I thought, why not, and got there, and I saw Vera Shirley. And the first thing she said, that I looked terrible, and sort of practically made me something to eat, and after I was revived a little bit, she gave me a test which I didn't pass.
A shorthand test.
Shorthand in typing, where I made loads of mistakes. And she talked to me. And then she rang Eleanor. And then she said, what you earn now, and I think it was 30 shillings. So she said, well, you can start, you know, give notice on £3. And Eleanor's permission, I was given the £3 to sort of get myself organized, as it were. And then I started, I don't know when, and I was taken over to Eleanor.
You hadn't seen Eleanor or Eva up till...
I hadn't seen Eva. I've never seen Eva. I've heard a lot of Eva.
Yes.
Because they worked very closely together on many issues. But I hadn't met Eva at all. And I was then taken to Eleanor in Tufton Court, which was just across the road. And she reminded me, and I was thinking about it the other day when I got your letter. Now, I didn't see her as a mature woman. I saw her as a 17-year-old girl. And I thought to myself, the first impression was, well, she looks like my grandmother, which indeed she did. And there was sort of the same sort of generous face. Sort of every wrinkle was a generous kind of wrinkle, but her eyes were extremely intense. And when she looked at you, she had this kind of, the way she focused on what you were saying and the intense interest she took. I later explained to myself by the fact that there was a woman of end of 60s at that time, or middle 60s, her whole life devoted to her pet subjects, family allowances, the cause of the internees. She worked for the checks coming over. She was in her lovely flat. Mrs. McAdam, I don't know if she... Have you met her? Is she still
alive? No, she's dead now, but I've heard a lot about her.
I've got a letter from her as well. I didn't realise, you know, until I sort of looked at her. And Mrs. McAdam, highly intelligent woman she shared the flat with, took off all the chores of housekeeping and etc. etc. No trouble with husbands or children, a maiden lady. So indeed, all her energy was channeled into what she was doing. So the single-mindedness of Eleanor, I've never ever met in anybody else. But with together with this sort of searching into people, there was some limitation, which was due, well, to her background, which we all know. Because while we were there, and Vera Kring, we used to laugh about it. There was a case of a little Polish Jewish boy in his 30s with his little case. He came to us for something. And we sent him over for some reason, I don't know, to Eleanor. And at the time, Mrs. Cox was Eleanor's secretary. And Vera and I said, well, he'll be the one who will touch her heartstrings. We knew perfectly well he'd been with his case to a half a dozen societies, and, you know, and sure enough, Mrs. Cox was very sweet, and really they got on very well. I mean, I was very much the junior in the show there. Sure enough, rang back that this little man touched Eleanor's heartstrings. You see, that was not within her experience. Her integrity was such that there might be sort of little Polish chappie who was living on his wits and might say his grandmother's just died and his wife is expecting three babies and whatnot. She just wouldn't. I mean, she would have been cross with us if we'd said, look, he's having you on. Because it was not within her experience.
You mean that she was gullible, in a sense? Is that what you're saying?
In a sense, if somebody brought her the kind of story and knew how to put it well, but she was shrewd at the same time, when it was within the people she had met.
I understand. So really she's a rather ideal combination, if I'm understanding you correctly, of warm-hearted and humanitarian and business-like.
Yes.
But that obviously she falls into difficulties with her warm-heartedness unless she's moving in an area which she knows well.
So absolutely
is that
correct.
What you
yes,
mean?
That is what I mean.
Yes, I think it's very interesting, yes. But do you think, first of all, there's a puzzle in what you say. Why were you taken on if you failed the test?
Well, I've been wondering that for a long time. there was a vacancy because the young lady was getting married. I think it was mainly due for my German background and the people who were being interned, and Eleanor was working on their release, were the kind of people who could have been my parents or my uncles. I think that was a plus. I think they had hopes that both my typing and my shorthand would improve sufficiently during the 2.5 or 3 years. It got a bit better, but I don't think I was ever very brilliant. And perhaps they thought that I could be relied upon, and that's a very important thing. I ought to mention there, that was the very first time I met Eleanor Rathbone. She said to me, now there is the one thing, Helga, anything which is going on in the office, you've just got to keep to yourself. Because she had access to home office files about detainees, which she was looking after as well, and internees. The detainees were detained under 18B, and there were a few cases where we helped as well because it was more or less the same kind of routine. So this was very important, and so I said to her, Miss Rathbone, you can rely implicitly, because for my 11th year I was told by my parents that walls have ears, because the wrong word leaking outside your home might have meant immediate arrest. And I think this was one of my great pluses, which probably, of course, was more important. And something did happen eventually, which I never ever told either Vera or Miss Rathbone, because I didn't want to incriminate other people. But some of the young people I met
they're concerned.
Yes.
I mean, that's more important than school
timing
and so on.
Well, so, as a matter of fact, what happened then was the mother of that particular youngster I knew said to me, look, Helga, we're all friends and so on. We know you're working for Eleanor. Now you can be very useful for to us, this sort of thing. Well, this was it. I broke up off friendship, etc., etc. I wasn't even that aware of it because I wasn't political ever, not even now. But I knew it was wrong, it was the wrong thing, and as I say, subsequently, these people went back to communist Germany. As a matter of fact, they were the very first ones to go. While to me, and even now, the idea of going back to Germany, I just couldn't, except if Denise should marry a young German, and I would welcome him with open arms. But the in-laws on the other side would be my generation, and I don't know what they did in those years. No, I mean, it sounds...
Yeah. I understand, but what did you actually have to? You were interviewed by Eleanor. She was kind to you, was she? Then you think?
Well, she was marvelous. I mean, she sort of treated me not as a grandchild, but as a youngster. She was always very interested in young people, I think. And subsequently, when I was working there, she asked me, well, Helga, what would have happened if you stayed at home? So I said, well, my idea always had been to join the teaching profession. Of course, as far as English standards were concerned, I sort of had no written qualifications. But as she was the member for Liverpool University, she knew the people responsible for the training colleges. And also, one of her great friends was Mr. Butler, then Mr. Butler. And she said to me, I tell you what I'll do. I mean, that was 2.5 years later, obviously. I'll have a word with Mr. Butler and see if somehow one can't make an exception in the test case being that I was the first alien, because I wasn't naturalized, I was the very first alien to receive government money to help me towards my studies. I felt that very strongly, because obviously if I'd made a mess of it, it would have been rather nasty for anybody else. And Mr. Butler agreed. And then she got hold of the director of education. They were then directors of education of the United Universities, I think it was then.
Combined
Universities. This is it. And, well, he was in London at the time, and he interviewed me, and, well, I spoke then fluent French and German, and, you know, so he felt, if I do the metric, promise to do the metric afterwards, it'll sort of... He'll close an eye.
So you then left Eleanor's service to train as a teacher, did you?
Yes, after 2.5 years.
Did you really? Yes.
Eleanor.
Of course, you had three languages as well, which has been a great help.
Yes.
As well. But I was really wondering, you see, it seems to me that Eva and Eleanor surround themselves with people who actually themselves benefit from working for them. They're not just working for refugees in the abstract, they're also employing refugees.
Oh, they were.
You know, and helping them personally.
Well, actively,
if you see what I mean.
Because the involvement was not paperwork involvement. It was direct communication. Now, I've made one or two notes because I did want to remember sort of one or two funny things. Yes, there was, for instance, the one day she was sort of inundated with work, and either Mrs. Cox was absent or had left her. So by that time, my typing was adequate for me to be in Tufton Court itself, because we had our little office in, I forget even, Vera Creek probably is mentioned.
Wasn't it over a bakery?
No. It was over a very well-known family business of solicitors who were also members of Parliament. And I think one of what would be one of the sons is now the chairman of the Race Relations.
Not Bonham Carter.
Bonham Carter, yes. That's right. Mm. It was the house belonging to Bonham Carters, and they had their firm of solicitors in the ground floor.
Yes.
But anyhow, I was sort of on a lend lease scheme there. And it was after hours, as it were. But of course, Eleanor, to her, the matter in hand was the important thing. And I don't know whether I sort of had a date with a boyfriend or whatever it was, you know, so I sort of vaguely mentioned that it was after seven, you know, I was hungry or something. Well, you know, I mightn't have mentioned it because she didn't even hear me. And we just went on. So this proves her incredible sort of intent on being, but yet at the same time being equally intent if you sort of...
Yes, she's single-minded. Something. I mean, it's an odd combination, isn't it, really? Because when her mind's on your welfare, nobody could be more helpful.
Oh, absolutely.
But when her mind's on refugees, she's quite unconcerned about you.
Well,
I mean,
yes,
personally.
Well, I mean, I was hungry, I was the lot.
Yes.
But she was hungry as well.
Yes, oh, yeah.
Or I would
That's
get
very interesting, yeah.
sort of little calls. I mean, as I was, you know, the general factotum there, I was the youngest. Mrs. Cox would ring Vera. Eleanor left a message, she hasn't got a handkerchief. So I would toddle over to the house. They knew me because I was semi-errant boy as well, and we were allowed even to run about in siren suits in those times. Even Churchill was.
Mm.
Toddle round and get the handkerchief to her.
Mm.
And of course, I'm sure Vera told you that she attacked Herbert Morrison with an umbrella once.
Oh, yes. I mean, she's a remarkable, formidable woman in many ways.
And also, there was another time, also while Herbert Morrison spoke, somebody whistled in the house, and everybody thought it was... nobody knew who it was, but they all felt it was Miss Rathbone. And then, of course, to crown it all, when she was hospitalized in Westminster Hospital, Herbert Morrison at the same time was there as well. You know, we sort of all used to have our little jokes about that.
Could you just tell me, first of all, what was the organization you were working for?
Yes. Now, a number of Member of Parliament had formed a committee, Parliamentary Committee on Refugees, it was called, and a little office was created with Vera Shirley as the immediate paid secretary, because she had had a lot of experience in Bloomsbury House, who had been dealing with refugees. Eleanor as the chairman, or Graham White was the chairman, but Eleanor, the one who was really responsible. We were just the staff. And ever so often there were meetings, I should think that there were at least 20 MPs on the committee, I'm not quite sure.
They'd meet in the house, would they?
They would have met in the house.
Yes.
But or sometimes in illness place. Very often they came to us, not in a body, but I remember seeing Graham White, definitely, very, very often. It's fairly long ago. I must have seen other people.
Mm.
We saw people from abroad, I don't mean immigrants now, who were also interested in the refugee problem, came to Eleanor, came to us, usually because of the language, if they were Swiss people, you see. And the main idea was to clear up what Eleanor called a mess of the internment. And this is probably what moved her, as I mentioned before, the human problem of some of those poor people trying to find a haven here before they knew where they were.
So what were you doing? Were you getting people out of internment?
Yes.
And placed somewhere in English life, or what?
Well, no, we didn't go as far as that. Now, what would happen, for instance, some wife would come along. My husband's been interned. Then we would ask for references. Very often it meant writing in German. I mean, even if it was badly typed, but at least I could write in German,
yes.
You see. Writing in German to verify any statements, finding, really building up a file, finding as many references, as many people who had known this particular person, either in Germany or in Austria or in Czechoslovakia, getting English references where they had been on arrival, where they had worked, compile the lot. Then we sent it to the Home Office Aliens Department, assuming obviously that he was interned, the husband was interned, and then we would get a letter back from the Under Secretary of State who was responsible for this. Well, he can be released, or he can't be released unless we provide further evidence that he really is what he claims to be. That went on for months. One occasion I remember very clearly, it was a plant. It was indeed a spy or somebody. And funnily enough, his wife, I recognized. I'm glad she didn't recognize me. I recognized
her. A Nazi spy, you mean?
Yes, and I don't think she was aware of it.
Hmm?
She couldn't have possibly aware of it.
Good.
And I met her, he was deported.
Hmm.
I met, after the war, I met her subsequently when the niece went to a dancing school locally. She was the secretary there. And I remembered her so very clearly, because she came very often to us to plead for her husband's...
So really you were a sort of intermediary between refugees' relatives with problems, or refugees who wanted to get out, and the government, really. That's
yes,
what you were.
But mainly the internment side.
I see.
Here and there might have been, sort of people might have come, and they might have found difficulties with employers. And when somebody came out, they gave us as a reference.
I understand, yes.
And, but the main function, definitely, was helping these people to prove that they were what they were, people who sought refuge.
So the office is very important in the whole thing in that case, because you the building up of the files is the central thing in a way, isn't it?
Amazing. I mean,
so what did you have in the office? You were employed, what, as a sort of office girl, really?
I was employed just general, really as an office girl, but because of the languages, being able to help, because we of course had Poles as well. That's a case in point. There was General Anders Army, And they were terribly anti-Semitic. So a body of Jewish boys came down from Scotland, they were stationed in Scotland, marched down from Scotland in Polish uniforms and came to Eleanor. Of course, she couldn't understand most of them, most they spoke French. Eleanor had them eventually transferred into the Pioneer Corps.
Mm.
And another thing she did, which was absolutely fantastic, one of them was a dentist who still practices now, very locally, and he was qualified in Lyon. Most of the Polish doctors and dentists qualified in France. I think it was Lyon. So, during the war, through Eleanor's contacts, somebody who was going over anyhow, parachuted down or whichever way, went, while he was there, to the university and came back with a photocopy to England to prove, I mean, this was also some of the sidelines which arose. And of course it did need not qualified staff but at least staff who knew, had affinity with these other refugees, which I had because I was one of them.
Yes, of course. You must, was it the case then that there was a terrific, I should imagine, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but was it the case that there was a terrific morale built up among you all because you yourself knew how important it
was? Well,
there
were only really the three of us. There was Vera Krieg,
yes,
who was terrific and has been terrific to me. She was wonderful. There was Eleanor, who knew about everything and okayed everything. Occasionally she sort of, and then we thought, well, we'll leave it a little while, we'll have another go later. Because we felt when she said no, it was because she just didn't appreciate the problem. I mean, for her, although she was so human, some of it was textbook. With us, it was practical. She didn't see everybody. We sent a lot of people over, but we didn't send everybody over, especially if we felt it wasn't going to help. So, and then there was me. That was the three of us,
yes,
because Mrs. Cox, she also...
She left fairly early on.
She left, but there was somebody else because Miss Rathbone had this tremendous interest as well in family allowances and her constituents,
yes,
after all, so...
Mm. So, just imagine yourself now, you're back in the office. What was there?
What was there? Well,
where it was above the Bonham Carter's house.
Yes, it was the top floor. It was a small, charming flat in one room. Vera had a bed sitting room. Then the biggest room was the office. It had two writing desks. One was Vera's, one was mine. Mine had the typewriter. We were inundated with files, which were on shelves, and my job was to do the filing, and you know, the piles of files always, because the telephone rang all the time. Files had to be got out, letters came below. There was sort of, you didn't have a routine because things went on the whole time, you never had a breather. I had to toddle backwards and forwards to Eleanor, sometimes to the House of Commons, you know, just for her to sign some of the important letters Vera couldn't sign. I had to go to the bank, we never had funds, because Vera's income was absolutely ridiculous. Most of the time it came out of Eleanor's purse, it was supposed to come out of the funds of the parliamentary committee, but the postage and the telephone bill, it was also very much more than one had anticipated. Mm. I usually ate in the office.
There were only two rooms. There was the bedroom that Vera, yes, Shirley had, and the main office.
The office, yeah, the kitchen, bathroom and toilet. Mm.
Mm. So it was really just a flat.
It was just a flat with one room used as the office.
But did refugees themselves go there?
Oh, yes, yes. We had it was very nice of the Bonham Carters, who are a wonderful family, and they were very aware. I mean, this should be the parents or grandparents of the present, very aware of the problem. I mean, you had all sorts of people coming up.
So they went through the Bonham Carter's house and were let in by the Bonham Carter's servants or whatever?
No, the door was open, and on one side was the solicitor's practice of the Bonham Carters. And, you know, very, very nice girls at the reception desk sometimes when we're locked in or locked out or, you know, the usual thing. And we were on the top floor. I don't know who lived in the middle, or whether it also probably belonged to the Bonham Carters' solicitors.
So Eleanor never went there then, is that right?
I can't remember Eleanor ever having come up, but I'm not sure. I certainly seem that the one figure which seems to be right in front of my visual mind is Graham White, who seems to have come up very often.
So you'd go down to Eleanor
and take instructions
from her, or Mrs. Shirley would.
Well, this is it.
But what about Eva?
She was working in her particular part of the world and meeting Eleanor outside somewhere where I don't know.
But she wasn't intimately involved.
In our place, not at all.
Yeah.
It was mere coincidence,
yes,
that I got into the parliamentary committee or in contact with Miss Rathbone. It was sheer...
It's just another part of Eleanor's life. It's not that part.
Completely different.
Yes, I understand. Yes. So that's really most interesting. So what was Eleanor like really to deal with? I mean, how did you presumably she was rather a formidable figure. You had to treat her carefully.
Well, to me she was formidable because, of course, she was practically, 55 years older, or a good 50 years older. And so to me, as a youngster anyhow, being shy, and also at that time I've still had great difficulties speaking English, because I'd only left in 1939 and had spent my time in France, so this was my third language, and I wasn't at all happy speaking English. It wasn't terribly fluent, so I was very, very shy, but as I said before, she was so wonderfully kind that obviously, and also I think she was one for the underdog. You know, I probably cut such a pathetic little self, you know, thin, undernourished, white looking. My daughter tells me I still can do when I'm not just returned from holiday. That obviously, I was the refugee or Arab Jew incarnate in a young version, which
made her sympathetic.
Made her so sympathetic.
Did you didn't yourself take letters from her then? I mean, it would be Mrs. Shirley who'd do that, would it? I mean,
I never took letters because my shorthand wasn't good enough.
You were really an assistant to Mrs. Shirley.
I was an assistant to Mrs. Shirley, but as I say, once or twice I was borrowed out and I, you know, was frightened stiff and was doing my very best to do the job well.
But you say she did actually take an interest in you personally.
Yes, she did.
Sometimes. How did that happen?
Very often.
Mm.
When she saw me, and as I say, I can only say, because perhaps I was little, she did feel that my education wasn't the kind of education that I should have been in a normal home situation, which it wasn't. So again, working from her own environment and her own experience of being brought up in a nice home, public school, university, to her it stood out so clearly, something is wrong, what can I do for her? And that is when she then prompted her to ask me, well, you know, what you want to do. And
otherwise you would have carried on there, would you? I mean, you weren't thinking of leaving particularly.
Well, no, I wouldn't have carried on, because A, it then began to fold up towards the problem solved itself.
Yes. Mm.
As a matter of fact, towards the end, I was again on lend lease to Mr. Gollins, the publisher. He published either it was a book or pamphlet, Let My People Go, towards the end of the war, directed obviously towards Germany. And there was so much work that he asked Eleanor, with whom he was also working, you know, was there anybody? And so I was sent, and that was very sweet of Eleanor. Even there in the office, it was a larger office, I wasn't used to a large office, the person in charge was a type I'd never come across. He was also a refugee who'd also worked for Eleanor in some sort of capacity, not in Tufton Court, but in some sort of, perhaps with the Czech thing. Anyhow, she knew him. And I was to work under him, cutting stencils and general office routine. And this man, who must have been in his 30s then, he was the most negative person I've ever met. I must have been 18 or 19 then. And I worked there for a week. I met Mr. Gollins, which was nice. He was wonderful. And I then said, well, this is pointless. I said that to myself. So I went to Eleanor and I said, it's just useless. When he gives me something to type, I'm not the best of typists, but the effect he has on me, I know beforehand, I'm going to make too many mistakes. It's just a useless exercise. So she understood that perfectly well, and sort of I could go back. I mean, it was anyhow only a temporary measure.
Yes, I see. And so she was understanding sort of person.
Oh yes, she was wonderful.
What about Miss McAdam, actually? Did you see much of her?
Yes, I saw her sort of more. No, she wasn't a housewife. She was sort of
housekeeper, really. Wasn't
no,
she,
no,
really?
No, no. She very much on the same level as
yes,
academically.
But she managed that.
She managed
side
that
of
side
of
it. I mean, Eleanor was the. I wonder if it'd help if I read you some of the
letters. Oh, do, please. Yes, that'd be very interesting.
The first one was July 1945. I was in college then. I'm glad to, dear Helga, I'm glad to know you are in London and should certainly like to see you. I have several engagements pending, so perhaps the best plan would be for you to phone me or my secretary, and if I'm out, you know, we could arrange to call. That's sort of straightforward.
Mm.
And she just sort of said, you know, even if I can't answer all your letters, it doesn't mean lack of interest, which was sweet. I mean...
That's from Elizabeth McCavan?
No, from Eleanor. And then there was absolutely a charming... That was actually March, which was before. Mm. I can hardly decipher it because her poor writing was very bad. So glad to get your cheerful letter. And then I was terribly worried what would happen at the end of the course, which was July 46. I had no home. I obviously hadn't a job. I didn't even know if they would employ me as an alien, because I was still an alien. I had no money. The Rathbones allowed me pocket money to buy books, etc. They were marvellous.
The family, you mean?
Well, Eleanor, and after her death, Jack Rathbone, the nephew, carried on. I mean, they were marvellous. So I must have written in my letter something, and she said, don't worry about the future, finish your course, and then we'll consider, you know, what's got to be done. And then she signed, she was obviously going to leave it there, and then she said, On reflection, I won't send this as a postcard. And she writes that about the position to returning to Germany. Well, she knew I didn't want to return to Germany. And she felt I had to have a word with Miss Allen, the principal. But the principal of this college, I mean, she was academically absolutely wonderful. So was her friend. But from a human point of view, nil. Absolutely nil.
So that wasn't really the right...
That wasn't... I mean, her friend said to me once, my maiden name was Cohn, Miss Cohn, we English do this, that and the other, you know, and it sort of prompted my friend Evelyn to go to the principal's place and read the riot act to both of them and nearly get expelled. But, I mean, it was just... lack of
sensitivity. Yes.
Anyhow, so I didn't go to Miss Allen. And then she writes that they'll help us, that will they'll help me to see I shouldn't in any case worry about it. And that she's going to find out about British naturalization and do her best to support anything. So don't worry your little head anymore. That's sweet. And just get on with your work, but play as well. Don't overwork. Best wishes. Wasn't that sweet?
Very nice, yes. So you kept in touch with Eleanor up to the end of her life, even though...
Well, I just realized that Miss McAdam's letter, that my letter was from Eleanor, was the 8th of December, 45. And Miss McAdam's letter was the 29th of January, so it was literally 1.5 months later that she died. And then she wrote to me again in October 29th. I'd seen her then, and, you know, I wrote that. We walked together in the house. It was absolutely marvellous. Had a meal there.
When was this, 45?
That was October 45.
Yes.
And again, by that time, there was the naturalization question was on the move, and she had guaranteed for me, and she said that that my claim was just about the strongest out with my background and with her. And then she puts again, don't overwork. Yours always Eleanor Rathbone. Isn't that sweet?
So she helped you to get naturalised as well, did
she? Yes, yes. Mm. Oh, she sort of didn't leave anything unfinished. And then the very last letter that was typed, she thanks me for the letter and she sent me another £20, closed another £20. And she was hoping that this will cover me comfortably, which was a lot of money then for books. I mean, textbooks were just nothing, so £20 for them. And then she writes in her own writing that she'd again seen the Home Secretary and she's hoping for a general statement on naturalisation. And indeed, it was her work. There were, as a result of her work, three categories for immediate naturalisation. Teachers, because there was then a shortage of teachers, funnily enough. Dentists and doctors sort of didn't have to wait the usual.
Professional people,
yes,
didn't it? Yeah.
Yes. And then, well, that was 8th of December, and then, of course, unfortunately, she died, and I wrote to Miss McCadden, and Miss McCadden wrote such a lovely letter. I know how much you will miss Eleanor Rathbone. She was so interested in your career. Please regard me as your friend on her behalf, and let me know about your progress. I shall be really interested, and thank you again for your kind sympathy.
So you kept in touch with Miss McCadden after 46, 45, then, did you?
For a little while, and then, of course, the probably Vera told you the Jewish organization, Jewish Association of Refugees, built a home for old age people, and they called it Eleanor Rathbone House. And I was invited, and I was very, very pleased because Jack Rathbone, the nephew, was there. And I went up to him, and I said, well, I'm one of your aunt's prodigies, and you know, I'm still teaching, so it wasn't all wasted. That was very nice.
But what was Miss McCadden like? I mean, they were a partnership, those two, weren't they? What was a partnership like? Can you describe it?
Well, she was struck me as very efficient, where Eleanor would forget her handkerchief and I had to take it. She was dressed very efficiently, must have been extremely efficient in organizing the meals and looking after all the duties in the house. Obviously there was a staff, but supervising. And Eleanor, in that sense, was completely absent-minded. One had the feeling she wouldn't know how to boil a kettle. And I could imagine that Miss McCadden said to her, well, look, you've worked enough, here's a cup of tea, or this sort of thing, or arranging, making sure that there were flowers there. Not that Eleanor would have seen the flowers, because she was too intent on this sort of relationship.
Yes. So they're really rather marvellous team.
Oh, they were a marvellous team. I was wondering, they might have been sharing, you know, since possibly their student days.
Oh yes, a long time. I can't quite remember when they started up together, but quite a long time. But what was Tufton Street like? Can you remember it? What was it? What is
well,
like
it was very elitist in those days. I don't know what it's like now. I haven't been, and many Member of Parliament lived in this particular area. It was so close to the house. It was then a very modern block of flats, with, you know, a kind of flat one would even be proud of now. Obviously not as streamlined as the kind of thing which is built now, being built now.
But was it a big flat? I mean,
yes, it was a fairly big flat. They were all big flats.
Mm.
I mean, I sort of vaguely remember the office and something which must have been a drawing room. I don't remember anything else. And of course, the Highgate home where I visited Eleanor while I was in college, that was tremendous. A wonderful property with beautiful gardens.
But the Tufton Street then was a sort of was quite a lavish sort of flat, really. I mean, she lived quite well, did she?
I don't think lavish would be the right word, because...
Well appointed.
Well appointed. I mean, there would be no ostentation in any way.
I see.
Possibly, not Puritan is the wrong word, but
austere.
I would think that's too strong.
Yes.
You see, there again, Miss McAdam's influence, whom one might even think might have come from a Puritan background, almost, judging by her dress. I mean, where Eleanor would have the odd brooch. And I've got pictures of Eleanor, but I don't know where I've got them.
Mm.
But the home in Highgate, which obviously was bought afterwards, I mean, they did not run the two homes.
There
was Tufton Court, and while I was in college, it can only have been her last 2 years.
Yes, because she was bombed in Tufton Street, wasn't she? There was a bomb there, wasn't there?
I didn't realise that.
So she, I think she must have moved out for that reason.
Or she must have moved out for that reason. That was a wonderful home.
And was it?
That, well, lavish is a little bit too strong, but we're getting near to lavish.
It had a
fantastic dining room. It had a beautiful drawing room.
With antique sort of furniture.
Yes, yes, that was very beautiful and a wonderful spacious garden.
Could I get you back to the office again? You said you had lots of files. How was this all organised when you were first there? I mean, you had a file for each refugee.
We had a file for each refugee.
Mm.
We had a card index, which was, all this was kept by me, according to how much time I had to sort of be, I wasn't all that efficient, I don't think. We had a cross card index. Vera had a wonderful system which worked if everything was in the right place. A file for every refugee, a card index which showed the number of the file. What else did we have? The typewriter.
I don't quite understand. Why do you need a card index to show the number of the file? I mean...
well, the files were either... I think the files were in number in the card index was in alphabetical order with the surnames of the refugees.
I see. I see. So you look up the person in the card index and then you get a number and you get the file.
Yes, I seem to sort of remember Q78 or something.
Yes, I see.
Yeah, I sort of mean vaguely to remember that.
Then you presume, would you have files concerned with particular types of problem like naturalisation or... illness or something like that?
No, it was the main body of files actually were personal files.
I see. Mm.
But there were some odd ones when these Polish Jewish soldiers, you know, odd files where we would classify which didn't seem sort of...
Because, I mean, there must have been common problems that arose, you know, of an analytic sort, if you see what I mean.
Yes, well, of course, we sort of didn't... In retrospect, you can look at it quite differently. Instead of being faced with the individuals and have a vertical building of files, you can have a different kind of way of looking at it altogether, a cross-section.
Mm.
For instance, we had a file, that's a point. That's another thing Eleanor was absolutely hot on, and which was an incredible... incredible injustice. I mean, even I, in my dim state at the time, realized this. There were a handful of, I don't know if Vera sort of mentioned that, that was something Eleanor fought most vehemently, a handful of German and Austrian doctors. One of them was a Professor Schach, who'd been one of the great people at Vienna Hospital. Mm. I don't know if Vera mentioned him. He was one of the chief European surgeons, but who'd stuck it in Vienna. It was his hospital till the last minute. And of course, their qualifications weren't recognized. Granted, an aptitude test in English would have been desirable. But these were people not like some of the Pakistani trained in some. They were Berlin, Vienna trained, Prague trained.
Mm, so it was an insult in a way.
It was an insult, and this man, to whom English people had gone to, had to work under a youngster somewhere so that he could practice at all. Mm. And the British Medical Council and Miss Rathbone bombarded them and had meetings with them, would not recognize their qualifications.
Mm.
They actually asked them to study the full course. Some of them were men in their 60s. I mean, it was, you know, it was heartbreaking. There was this, there were sort of problems, so that would have been common to the doctors. This was apart from the actual internment.
Did you must have had some really terribly sad cases who came there.
We had some dreadful cases. We had many dreadful cases, because don't forget, not only were there the women whose husbands might have been interned, whose children might have gone with what was then called the Youth Aliyah to Israel, which was then Palestine, but whose parents might have been in Auschwitz or any of the other camps. So it was dreadful, but no different. I mean, you're a historian and history repeats itself, no different from what happened in Bangladesh, no different from what's happening in Africa. And the parallel being there, we always used to say, well, by we, I mean the older generation, not myself, I was too young. Why doesn't anybody do something about us? But by the same token, I say to myself, we're sitting pretty here, and we're not really doing anything either.
Mm. Well, Eleanor was a remarkable person, taking that interest, wasn't she, at that time, so unusual. In seeing the desperate need that existed at that time. Did this mean then that you worked all hours? I mean,
well, we usually, what happened was, if there wasn't a bombing, sometimes there was a bombing, I got bombed out as well. If sort of one had slept reasonably well, I had a bicycle, trundled, cycled, and arrived there between 9:30 and 10:30. Sometimes I sort of had to wake Vera up. She suffered from terrible migraines, and sort of when I was in charge myself. And I mean,
because she used to get rung up in the night, she said. I mean,
she used to get rung by desk, by desk. By people who were desperate.
Mm.
They were literally desperate, because a poor woman like that, she was an alien at best. You see, the job she could get, there was a law that aliens weren't allowed to work in their walks of life, most of them, and this includes university graduates, were, if they were men, were porters in Lyons, what was then Lyons Corner House, or some other sort of navvy if they were strong enough. And the women, they were all domestics. They were suddenly wonderful pastry cooks in households, which was all right if you could take it. I mean, I'm not talking about myself, I'm talking about the older generation. And if you had a terrific sense of humour,
yes,
and if you didn't have too many other worries. But if you succumbed emotionally and then had some poor person, English person, who couldn't possibly be alive, aware of the problem, sort of say something silly, not knowing that she was saying something silly, sort of the traumatic situations.
Yes. So really, it was quite a demanding sort of job, really, for you to have. I mean,
oh, it was.
Which you had to be dedicated to, in a way.
Well, it was my life at the time. Because, well, it was my life and my home, because I must say, it was incredible, and Miss Rathbone was sort of a kind of, well, if one were religious, possibly a Virgin Mary or something,
sort of
you know,
or
your fairy godmother. This is really how it worked.
I was wondering whether you've got any more things on your notes that we haven't brought out about Eleanor, because I don't want to miss anything you think is important. You've given a marvellous picture of how it all worked. What were the dates you were there, actually?
I've been thinking about that.
It was for 2 years or...
It was a little over... Well, I know it was an October fog when I went for this interview.
That would be October 1940, would it be? Or 39?
No, it was later. I came to this country. I only came to this country in 39. You see, I was in France first.
Must have been 1940 then, wasn't it?
It was 44. I went into college.
41?
I must have been there, that's right, about October 41.
Yes.
Until 44.
Actually, it was probably rather lucky because John Lewis was bombed very badly, wasn't it? If you'd still been
working
there.
This is right. Yes, John Lewis was bombed.
Presumably after you, it was bombed after you left.
I'm just wondering whether it was about the time.
Not to worry anyway, it's probably a good thing you moved.
Interest in youth, specialisation.
You really did feel she was interested in young people as such, did you?
Well,
not just in you, but generally.
It's very difficult to say that.
Mm.
And also, you see, this is when I thought about Eleanor generally. You see, young people now and young people then, interested in young people probably who would have conformed to her pattern. I wonder, Eleanor, if she'd been faced like we are now, I'm thinking now with a background as a teacher, how she would have fared.
Well, it's interesting, actually, I will tell you something Mrs. Shirley said. Mrs. Shirley and Mrs. Cox were both together when I talked to
her. Oh, that was nice.
Because I brought them together. Yes. And they had a laugh, really, because they thought that Eleanor was really quite hopeless when it came to anything involving sex. I mean, she was absolutely
absolutely hopeless.
Terribly repressed and sort of...
Yes, well, this is, I mean, was her...
So, that, I mean...
Yes, that was
that
her upbringing, their upbringing.
Hopeless.
But, of course, when we were young, we were different. from your generation and Denise's generation.
Much
and
more inhibited, I suppose.
We were...
Private.
Well, I should think we were generally more inhibited. And don't forget, had to be more adult, because after all, we were living in London, the war was on.
Mm.
There was the sort of general panic, exaggerated, but panic about living and air raids. Mm. And so obviously we weren't that free. And the other thing which is remarkable to me, comparing the various stages of youth, and that brings me back to Eleanor. Now, in our times, and this is, you know, obviously we didn't have television. We spent hours when we were in college, and it may be in men's colleges, I don't know, or it may have been in your generation, hours and days and nights and weekends discussing the world from every possible political, philosophical, every angle.
Mm.
Now you get the most intelligent youngsters now. And there is not that depth of searching. We were searching. Our generation was searching.
Yes.
And there you had a link with Eleanor, a searching youngster, a searching lady, never mind the fantastic generation gap.
You mean you felt you had in common that both of you were looking for ideals, looking for better ways of running things, you know, that sort of thing. Mm.
But I don't know how many of us, again, perhaps I was just in a circle of searching.
Anyway, you didn't feel that she was totally uncomprehending of you as a much younger person. She was
not at all. No, not at all.
Mm.
But how she would have fared perhaps with somebody, perhaps I was myself a bit intense.
Yes.
With somebody more frivolous.
Yes.
That I don't know.
Yes. No, that's interesting. But still, carry on.
Yes, I'm surprised. You know what? Because, of course, Vera will have seen her as a grown-up woman.
Yes,
she was in her 30s. I was 17, 18. So, obviously, my view of her, my Eleanor, is going to be different.
Yes, of course, that's why I come to see you.
Yeah, right. Yes, I put here, you know, how did she strike a 17-year-old? Grandmotherling appearance, highly intelligent, coupled with a certain shrewdness, beautiful smile, wonderful searching eyes, focused on the speaker with intense interest. I didn't put any more.
She did have that extraordinary single-mindedness and dedication, didn't she, which meant that in some ways she was unworldly. But on the thing she was focused on, she was first rate.
She was first rate, but the funny thing is, with her, and I've also thought a great deal, you know, since I had your letter. Now, I couldn't make up my mind if her academic way of thinking was taking over her humanity, or whether her humanity, you know, it's, I don't know quite where the dividing line, very difficult, and that is only something really she herself sort of could have answered. You couldn't.
I mean, you don't feel, you're wondering whether she was interested in people because her mind told her she must be.
Yes.
Or whether her natural interest in people forced her to develop an academic interest in the subject.
Yes, I mean, and she had legal training.
Mm.
So, obviously, no better training than that for literally diving and delving.
Mm.
And whether it was the training
Yes, she didn't
which
do.
Which prompted her to.
Yes, yes. She did social research, of course, as well
yes.
as
well, this is
the degree.
It.
She really was a very intelligent woman.
Oh, she was a highly intelligent woman, but
yes.
with a limited experience
yes.
of life.
Mm.
I mean, her life. And I don't mean that in any derogatory sense, is a textbook's life. I mean, she got her experience through reading literature and the classics, but it will have been a sheer run of non-meeting any, it's practically a prescribed course.
Yes, I mean, relatively simple, uncomplicated
life, uncomplicated.
In a way.
And
which
and
must
very
have limited
special,
her sympathies
well,
in a way. I mean, she could. She wasn't. What you're really saying is she wasn't a complete person, inevitably, because
she,
of
well,
not
that's
marrying,
a,
not having children, being
a
wealthy
strong,
woman.
A strong way to put it.
Mm.
She wasn't not. She wasn't a complete person because she was married, she hadn't children. It's very difficult to say that.
Mm.
How far, you know, she had sort of mental illuminations into life.
Mm.
Perhaps she had it privately.
Mm.
I mean, who is there to know?
Yes. Mm. She didn't give you the impression of being particularly incomplete.
No, but I mean,
there must have been areas where she was inexperienced.
That would be so difficult for me to say
yes.
because
mm.
I mean, I was only 17, 18 when I met her later on when I was 21 in college. Must have been 21. We were talking on a different plane.
Mm.
She sort of suddenly, the mere fact, and that is quite revealing in a way, I wasn't that little girl anymore because the fact that I sort of had entered academic education sort of filled sort of a gap I had covered, which she sort of thought wasn't right, you know.
Mm.
And so, she was talking to me more like an equal, belonging
yes,
to her world. Yes, to her
and,
world. But before that, I was a child at best, which I wasn't, I looked. But she could not typecast me in anything which had been within her experience.
I understand, yes.
But once I was a student, this was something she had experienced, and well, she could cope with that. From that point of,
I can't remember whether you told me where you were a student actually.
We were very lucky. We were evacuated to the Lake District, and we had a wonderful time near Derwent Water.
I see. What was the name of these?
St. Catherine's College.
I see. Yes. Well, so you were very lucky. One last question. You were working for the refugee organisation or the internee organisation for 2 years. How did it change in the course of your time there, the organisation? How was it different at the end from what it had been at the beginning, sort of thing?
Well, it struck me as terribly busy at the beginning, but probably this is subjective because as I couldn't cope at all at the beginning, as I probably cope better after 2 years.
Mm.
It probably seemed less busy. It was 44. Obviously, there were less cases coming up, and we were branching out more into different things, such as the doctors or the Polish Jews, and probably a few other things I've forgotten or possibly wasn't even aware that it was such an important problem, or I wouldn't have been able to go to Gollens. But yet at the same time we must have been very busy because I don't know if you remember when there was this terrible accident over the Gulf of Biscay an aeroplane accident where, incidentally, Leslie Howard, this film actor, well, they thought that Churchill was going over to one of his Yalta meetings and that, and on this plane was an acquaintance of Eleanor who had done an awful lot also for Jewish people and refugees. And while he was away, his secretary was on loan to us. This is how it worked. With all these semi-voluntary bodies, we were trotted around other voluntary organizations. So we must have been still fairly busy on less of the internment cases.
I see. So in the early years, it's emergency dealing with individual cases, getting them out of the internment.
I should think this was
and
more
as time goes on, you're broadening your interest to deal with the related problems.
Well, obviously there were people then, obviously, as the cases were the soldiers who weren't interned, the dentist who weren't interned, it was some follow-up of the original work. And of course, when I left, went to Liverpool, to the Lake District, it was still going on. But it must have changed or closed down or possibly combined with something else because Vera then went to Fallingbostel, the UNRWA camp. And the office definitely was dissolved because I remember her brother took over the flat. But I don't know how soon after that was.
But when you say that you work like this among a lot of voluntary organisations, what other voluntary organisations were you related to?
Well, a voluntary organisation is, I think, the wrong word, sort of people who had interest in refugee problems. And not necessarily organisations, because that person I'm thinking of, he was an English Jew, who his name was Israel, whose parents had one of the biggest stores in Berlin. So I was told then I didn't know, and he was the youngster.
So really, you're saying that Eleanor's in the middle of a group of people with similar interests, but all of whose secretaries are to some extent interchangeable. I mean,
Not necessarily interchangeable. Well, but Eleanor possibly was being the Member of Parliament and so well known and obviously very revered. I mean, as soon as I mention even now to any ex-refugee who might have been in this country for 40 years, odd years, you know, obviously, what did you do? How one asks, especially if it's a professional person. I'm thinking of my dentist even, you know, how is it you're in the teaching profession, you know, same age group, and I said, well, Eleanor Rathbun. Ah, Eleanor Rathbun, you know, this is, and it was even then that all the people interested, Eleanor was somebody very special, divorced from the humdrum of life by her very person, her very presence. And so she was almost a focal point in that way.
That's very interesting, because you see there are two figures like that in the women's movement. Well, three figures in between the wars in England in the women's movement. There's Ray Strachey, who you probably haven't come across.
No, I haven't.
There's Eleanor.
Yes.
And there's Eva Hubbard. They're focal points, as you put it. They're people who bring people together, the centre of networks. Do you see what I mean?
Well, but the funny thing is with Eleanor that she would have been unaware that she was a focal point, and she would have been too modest to regard herself as such. But her name, and Eleanor is dealing with that, is interested in that. So just to mention her name, so this Mr. Israel, who was a very wealthy businessman, an Jewish English businessman, obviously did an awful lot because he had this store in Berlin, possibly started off by helping some of his employees, obviously having his residence in London. Hearing that Eleanor was doing something about it, his ordinary secretarial work for the store was done by somebody else, or the winding up of the store, but he had just one extra person, a youngster actually like myself, a couple of years older, who spoke German, who was doing that part for him, and naturally he would get in touch with Eleanor, because through our office we would have the know-how, how to approach the Home Secretary, etc., etc. In this way, she was the focal point.
Yes. And then there's Galanx as well.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Who's another person she
well,
got
again,
with.
Again, and obviously he was in very close touch with Eleanor, and this is always something which amused me, surprised me, not amused me. There you had Gollancz, who, very much a Jewish person, one of, I mean, I'm saying that, I'm pretending that I haven't got the Jewish heritage. He had sort of all which is nice, like any people, you know, through the, all the various things which did happen, where Jews unfortunately evolved a certain arrogance, which is the byproduct of being pushed about. Well, you know, it's cause and effect. Well, there was so very much a wonderful Jewish person like Gollancz, who's completely different from Eleanor, and it was lovely to think that such completely different types could work in such good harmony. And this was the great thing with her. She could sort of overcome, although she had that limited upbringing, possibly academically overcome or humanely overcome, the complete gap between what must have been originally a Polish-Jewish background on Gollancz's part. Then, through one or two generations, I don't know the background sufficiently.
But this would be her single-mindedness again, wouldn't it? Her single-mindedness enables her to forget unimportant things like the fact that you've got a Polish-Jewish background and focus on the important thing, the refugees.
Yes, well, it wouldn't interest her too. Who's...
But and if she'd been a more rounded, in a sense, more complete person, she might have been less effective in getting people together, because she would have been more concerned with their individual.
Well, no, it shouldn't limit. I mean, the thing is, I had always found myself people who have been around more are more accessible to the other people who might have polka dots and be striped and have all sorts of varieties, because you've met something similar, you've met a little bit of that type. But that Eleanor, who had such a straight line of life, that she could sort of, it didn't worry her, like it worried so many people. Who were so highly educated, and as soon as they met a foreign professor, the fact that his ideas were of a very high standard, but he delivered them with a slight accent, it jarred something in them, while with Eleanor, perhaps of the intensity, I don't know, something, I don't think, she probably didn't even notice.
Yes, she focused on the thing.
The matter in her.
That's very interesting. I'm